The RTE Rugby Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the RTE Rugby Podcast, coming to you in this gap week in the Six Nations Championship, which is Ireland and France joined top of the men's tournament with two wins from two, Ireland and England top of the women's championship with two wins from two, and Ireland 1 point ahead of England in the under 20 men's championship, each with two wins out of two. So a very healthy start for Ireland across the board. And there are plenty of stories away from the Six Nations as well, so lots to discuss. I'm joined in studio by two colleagues in RTE Sport, Declan Whelley and Raf Diallo, and we will be joined later by Paul Rees of The Guardian, who has been breaking stories about CVC and their interests in rugby, which would seem to include putting some of the matches in the Six Nations Championship behind a paywall. And we'll also hear from Irish second row Judy Bobbitt, who made her Six Nations debut in Ireland's 31-12 win over Wales in some atrocious weather last Sunday. But a few news stories knocking around. First of all, and most eye-catchingly, Declan, South Africa potentially joining the Six Nations Championship.
Yeah, I suppose some people might see this as maybe somewhat of a natural progression, though, that we've got the Kings and the Cheetahs and the Pro 14. There are people who have could argue the merits in that either way. And as interesting enough, last weekend, while the Six Nations was going on, the Cheetahs were playing the Kings in a Pro 14 match. And I'm sure that probably went under the radar for most Irish rugby fans. But it seems like there's a growing appetite, particularly among South Africa, the Rugby Federation, to make the move. And they have kind of intimated in the past that they would leave their kind of present situation. But a lot of this comes down to money and contracts. So I know talks are ongoing at the moment, but it looks like they really are kind of... It's more than an interest. It looks like they're actively trying to get involved now in currently the Six Nations.
And it'd be more lucrative for South Africa and possibly a friendlier time zone.
And there are other advantages like the time zone issue that they have to deal with playing in the Rugby Championship, because obviously, more or less, they have similar time zones to us, whether it's, you know, 1 or 2 hours out. So it's a bit easier. Obviously, the travel is still going to be an issue, but getting to New Zealand, Australia, Argentina has been a challenge for them. I guess it comes down to that debate between, say, those traditionalists who would prefer to keep the Six Nations or whatever it was previously, the Five, Four, in Europe, rather than doing what the Pro 14 have done and brought in, you know, another... you know, teams from a different continent. And there is obviously the debate as well whether it does anything to help the tier two nations in rugby, like Georgia, who are kind of out in the cold or in that kind of area where you know, with a bit of improvement, potentially they could be that seventh team. But it seems the current owners, or at least beyond 2024, they're looking at the lucrative side of it rather than the developmental side of rugby in Europe.
And would it rip up the southern, what is effectively the Southern Hemisphere Championship, with Argentina, New Zealand, Australia and South Africa? Or potentially, at the moment, the dates South Africa could play in both? I mean, what are we hearing about that?
And you look at Argentina as well, because they've only come in to play more top-class competitive rugby. And now if you're Australia and you're New Zealand, who probably have questioned probably the merits of Argentina, even though they need the competition to swell their own coffers, I'd imagine there'd be a lot of unease at what's developing. And I've seen in some places where some believe that South Africa are kind of just playing high stakes poker, and maybe some don't fully believe they want to make the move because New Zealand and Australia wouldn't simply allow this to happen. But I don't know, it seems like this contract in CVC, that there really is momentum behind this.
Yeah, but one of the big criticisms during the World Cup, and an ongoing criticism, is that the top countries are pulling further away from the lesser countries, and that's only going to increase this if South Africa come to the Six Nations, possibly stay in the Rugby Championship. And the likes of Georgia, as you mentioned, Argentina, they're certainly not cut off from the Rugby Championship. They're having a great success in it. But even the Japans and those who'd like to get in there, if it's all concentrated in so few teams, it's not really spreading the game. It's not doing what World Rugby is supposed to be doing.
That's true, but maybe there's an argument that you look at Italy's performances in the Six Nations and you think, you know, true, maybe a Georgia could have come in, but are they adding any value that maybe you need? Maybe this could be the kind of maybe they might bring in South Africa, but we may also bring in a promotion relegation to offset that. So perhaps they might do some little changing of the current format with that.
Yeah, they won't. I spoke to the Six Nations about that. So they had a few questions just regarding Italy, and they came back and said there are no plans at all for promotion or relegation.
In its current format.
But even beyond that, it doesn't seem... Well, again, at the time I'd spoken to them, this South Africa thing hadn't happened, but it seems they've always been consistent about not having that promotion relegation and keeping things separate, which, as you said, when there's, you know, lip service being paid to the idea of growing the game, doesn't really help anyone outside of the top sides that are there.
Yeah, like, it's just going to... The Georges, and if Italy were to say be effectively demoted, if it was to be a South Africa for Italy straight replacement, I mean, you can forget about Italy at that stage, and so you'll have about 9 or 10 competitive countries, and forget about a 20-team World Cup. I mean, people say Japan caused upsets, and Japan caused an upset in the previous World Cup, but they are so few and far between, and this will just make the gap even bigger, won't it?
Yeah, it certainly will. I think if you have realistic ambitions of growing the game, you have to open pathways for the teams that are below the very, very top level to have an opportunity to actually play the top teams regularly, because it's the only way they're going to get better.
And we're going to have Paul Rees on talking about CVC, and we might put something similar to him about how it looks like the championship in England, the second tier in England, they're going to have a savage cut, 50% cut in funding for next season to the clubs, and it's potentially leading to a ring fencing of the Premiership in England. But Saracens will be very interested in some of the things going on there. Of course, they're demoted to the Championship for next season. Just coming back to the Six Nations, probably the biggest thing on our agenda at the moment in this part of the year. Of course, down week, Ireland are meant to have an open training session in Cork today. The heavy rain has put pay to that. They've moved from Cork IT to Musgrave Park, but it's just the players and the under-20s training there, and the whole Cork IT experience is off. But the talk is that, you know, Max Deegan has been released back to Leinster for the Pro 14. Caelan Doris likely to come back in at number 8, would you say? And it'd be back to as you were in the back row for the Scotland game, Stander at 6 and Van der Fleer at 7?
Yeah, pretty much. We didn't really get to see much of Caelan Doris, given he had to leave the field after a couple of minutes, although his couple of minutes, or I think it was 4 minutes in the end, actually proved to be quite positive and in terms of winning the ball back for Ireland. So it's an opportunity for him to at least get a proper run out, hopefully, against England, and it'll be it's obviously a tough challenge going away as well. But we hadn't had the opportunity to see what that newly formed back row would look like, and it's obviously something Farrell had in mind for the tournament. So now we get a chance to see how that actually gels together.
And in fairness to Max Deegan, even Leinster, they've found it difficult to kind of decide between the two who should be the regular starter. Now, you know, recently it's Caelan Doris has got the more regular nod, but for, you know, the last 18 months, it seems like it's been kind of almost like splitting hairs. So there seems to be very little between them there at provincial level. So it probably only stands to reason at the moment, there's probably very little between them at international level. But like you say, it seems that it was just unfortunate that Doris' day was cut so short, but he'll be back in. But you'd imagine Deegan is still very much in the frame there.
And no other obvious changes for Ireland. It'll just be injury related, really, I would expect.
It doesn't seem like it. The talk, should Conor Murray be in the team, is probably, it's not quite as intense as it was. Well, particularly the start of the competition, though, a lot of people still believe that maybe he should be in the team, but this kind of, the public discussion seems to have dipped a little bit, but it helps when you're winning. You know, we're seeing after post Twickenham, if it's the same team and we lose there, I'm sure that could ramp back up again. But at the moment, it looks like a pretty settled team.
It was interesting the way himself and John Cooney were put up together at the press conference. It's not something I think we would have seen in the previous regime.
No, but I think obviously the IRFU know that the two will behave anyway, for want of a better word, but that it'll be fine between them. And I think, as they said in the press conference, that they had played together at underage, so they know each other very well. And obviously there is that, I suppose, competitiveness that's naturally there, but you know, you're not going to get into a row with somebody that you know quite well over a long period of time, hopefully. And in their case, they both seem quite level-headed, so it was fine. I think the IRFU kind of predicted that this had been a debate. It's a nice way to quell it, put the two of them smiling together
I didn't believe that Conor Murray was the most convincing when he said it was the media making it awkward, as the two of them are sitting beside each other and asked to speak about each other's games, you know.
Yeah, that's true. Pro 14 back this weekend. Munster at home to Southern Kings on Friday, and then three matches on Saturday with Irish provinces. Leinster Cheetahs, that's at 2:30 in the afternoon. There's Ospreys Ulster as well, and then Connacht Cardiff, a late evening kickoff in the sports ground. The forecast for this weekend is pretty shocking. If that match goes ahead, it is a really important one for Connacht, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, and because they're on such a poor run, they've got two interpros and three other games, so they're last five on the bounce, and this is a home game, but they're followed up by two away games in a row, and one of those is Edinburgh, who currently top the conference. So Andy Friend said this is kind of do or die for them this season, because he said they had two goals. One was to make the knockout stage of the Champions Cup, and that's gone, but the other was as a home quarter final in the Pro 14, so they desperately need a win now this weekend.
Yeah, and like if they fall away, those last four or five matches could be not meaningless, and it's every match is important, but if they don't have anything to play for, it's a real downer for the last few games, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly would be, and I kind of expected a little bit more from them this year, given it's a World Cup year, and the last time it was a World Cup year, they went on, and obviously, well, they weren't going to go and repeat exactly what they did in 2015-16, but you would have thought with a lot of the other provinces having been affected with a lot more players being involved in international matches, that this could have been the year they could have taken advantage. Hasn't quite worked out that way, which is a pity, especially for someone like myself who's actually from the the region or the province anyway.
And they've shipped a couple of heavy beatings in the season as well. Like, you know, you don't normally, if Connacht lose, they kind of seem to edge out, or, you know, they're edged out, but they've taken shipped a couple of heavy beatings, so it has been very inconsistent for Andy Friend, but he maintains they're on the right direction, but we'll see over the course of the next three games.
And a blow for them coming at the end of the season, Colby Fainga, he was their players' player of the year in his first season last season. He's played 32 times for Connacht. He's been pretty impressive, and he's likely to go to Lyon in France for next season.
Yeah, it's a big blow, and they're losing someone who's kind of a cornerstone of their team. I think he started five of the six pool games for Connacht, so he's an integral part of that back row. So, they're going to have to look now to kind of readdress their back row. They've had a lot of injury problems over the course of the season, but trying to find a replacement for him at the same level he's been playing at since he arrived from Australia will be difficult.
Right, well, we're joined on the line by Paul Rees from The Guardian. And Paul, you've been breaking some stories about CVC, the venture capital firm, and their interests in rugby. Just bring us up to speed. What percentages of what tournaments do CVC own at the moment?
They've got 27% of the Premiership in England, and the same percentage of the Pro 14.
And they are sniffing around the Six Nations, more than sniffing around the Six Nations.
More than, oh crikey, yes. I think they've been locked in formal negotiations since September. And obviously it's with the Six Nations, but it's about more than the Six Nations Championship. I mean, they're going to aggregate the rights of all six unions, which is a marked departure. So they'd be selling the championship, but also their autumn internationals.
And what kind of percentage are they looking for in the Six Nations, do you know?
Well, originally the talk was it was 30%, but I think that's come down to 15% now, which is valued at some £300 million, which is a huge value on the, as I say, the championship, but all their internationals as well. Massive value for £300 million, 15%. Because when you think the Pro 14 and the Premiership, it was £320 million for both. So you can see the premium they place on having international rugby.
And what are the unions thinking about the advances of CVC? Are they welcoming these?
Yes, I think they are. Because last year you had the World Rugby Nations League plan, and this was designed to coordinate better matches between the hemispheres, especially the July and November windows, where you give them a sort of a greater competitive element than world ranking standings. And the Six Nations through that, Scotland and Ireland in particular, because it would have had relegation as part of it, not starting for 10 or 12 years, and they didn't like the idea of that. So So they kicked that into touch and then got into negotiations with private equity firms like CVC, so they could be in charge of their own tournaments. Now, of course, the downside is that whereas the Nations League plan, all the profits made would have remained in rugby union. Clearly now, if they accept the CVC deal, 15% of the income made through European international rugby every year will go out of the game and into the pockets of CBC.
And do you think that is agreement far away, or do you think it's pretty much over the line, and what are the sticking points?
Well, when I spoke to Ben Norell at the Six Nations launch, which was, what, 3 or 4 weeks ago, he said that, he didn't say an announcement, he said a decision would be, he expected a decision to be made within weeks rather than months, and I sort of put it to him, before the end of the Six Nations. And he didn't dispute that. I mean, I think that there are going to be sticking points. I mean, one, if you look at the history of sort of private equity investing in business, not just sports, what they tend to do is come in, lump it with a load of debt, use the debt to pay themselves dividends. Just think of the Glazers at Manchester United, or look at companies like Debenhams and Saga in recent years. And then, they can make their exit having made a nice big sum. Look at Formula One, for example. Mm-hmm. Now, what is the best way for CVC to get any private equity company, to get a big return on international rugby? And that is through television rights. But it wouldn't be television rights from free-to-air companies, would it? It would be through subscription stations. Now, you sell Six Nations TV rights, and you include the likes of Sky, BT, try and get in Amazon, whoever, and you can make a lot more money than you can now. But the downside for that, and this is a big thing for the Six Nations, is your audience probably goes down to a quarter if you're lucky of what it is, and the profile, your rugby union's profile, is very much international rugby. It's not the club game. Viewing figures for Pro 14 and the Premiership are fairly minuscule, whereas you're packing in for some Six Nations games in the UK 8 or 9 million viewers. Now, you haven't got a hope of getting that in with subscription, but you get the money, and that ultimately will be the decision. So the money or the profile. Now, if you come up with a hybrid model, especially November is pretty much wall to wall subscription anyway, isn't it? I mean, Ireland, England have gone down that road, and Wales have been considering it. But if you try and keep as much of the Six Nations on terrestrial as possible, then you're almost satisfying both. You're getting extra money, you're getting profile. But from CBC's point of view, is the Six Nations, 15% of Six Nations, worth £300 million if they can only sell a small chunk of the championship rights to the highest bidder?
Why do they need CVC? Is it beyond the... Now, I know the English union is certainly cash-strapped, but why can't the unions organise this themselves?
Because I think they're all if not cash-strapped, let's say they're all financially challenged. I mean, you look at the problems. Why did the Premiership go down CVC route? Because they're all losing money hand over fist. They just couldn't make it pay after 24 years of professional rugby. Now it's not quite the same with the unions, but they face the same problems. It's balancing, the professional side of the game with the community side of the game. And in some of them, they're spending, they're having to spend more on the professional side. And you think of, Wales, for example. I mean, Ireland have been fairly lucky. You've managed to retain almost all your players who the national coach wants. In Scotland and in Wales, it's different. You're fighting the wage inflation of clubs in France and England. And that means you're having to divert more towards the professional game and away from the amateur game. Look at Australia, the mess they're in, because they, 4 or 5 years ago, they put a lot in the professional model, had some extra Super Rugby franchises, paid a lot more money to play, didn't work, and they're having to sort of go back, and they're paying the price of an amateur game that's lacked investment now, and so they face a crucial few years. So that's the same for the unions. But of course, because you're surrendering 15% of your profits each year, it's not a case of getting the 55 million quid lump sum from CBC and splurging it. You've got to hold some of it back in case the extra revenue doesn't arrive, and your actual sort of incomings every year start going down a little bit. And that's what they're doing in the Pro 14, isn't it? The unions are getting that money from CBC, but they're not splashing it. They're going to keep a lot of it back in case there's a rainy day.
Yeah, I should say that the November internationals are still on terrestrial over here anyway as well. But is it a high risk strategy, do you think, by the unions?
Yes, there is an element of risk because they, as I say, they could get the lump sum, but find that their annual income goes down, and so over a period of 10 years they could lose. It's unlikely. I think what is interesting in this, and obviously these negotiations are, both teams have signed confidentiality agreements, so they're not the actual details. They're not allowed to divulge. But I think what is interesting on this, if you're going to beef up the November internationals here and the July internationals in the south, then you've got to get the Southern Hemisphere nations on board, because you're not going to get if suddenly Six Nations are getting a load of extra money, which, France and England, I know, in a meeting last year, felt they should have a greater share of the proceeds than the other four unions, because they had the greatest playing populations. Then that money will go in. More money goes to English clubs, French clubs, who can hoover players from the Southern Hemisphere. So there's no way New Zealand would agree to come over, even with the current tour schedule, if there wasn't something in it for them. Same with Australia. And so I think, and this might be CBC's plan, because ultimately, if you're going into international rugby, the biggest prize is New Zealand. It's sort of rewarding the Southern Hemisphere nations for taking part in the beefed up November and July series. Now, again, whether that would wash with the Six Nations, I don't know. It's all part of the negotiations.
Well, could it be a very roundabout way to a new sort of a World League? Because something we spoke about earlier in the podcast was South Africa coming to the Six Nations, possibly sometime, maybe.
Yeah, because if CBC do agree this deal, then having the commercial rights, the Pro 14, and for the Premiership, that European rugby is pretty much in their hands, so they could start then trying to get a better join with the Southern Hemisphere, because ultimately for them it's going to be matches that make it pay, that make it attractive for television, but also for sponsors, and that's not going to be sail plain London Irish, is it?
Just two other things on it. It's going to be packaged with the Women's Six Nations. Is it all upside for the Women's Championship, do you think, if that's the case? In terms of TV, so it's going to be sold, I should say, when I say packaged, I mean from a TV point of view.
Yes, yeah, and again, it gives you more to sell, doesn't it? And that's a sort of lesson of football, isn't it? So you bundle everything, you've got more to sell, and then you've got more chance of attracting multiple bidders.
In multiple kickoff times as well. You have that at the moment, but it'll probably become even more diverse.
Yes.
Just one other thing. I saw the stories from earlier in the week about the fairly savage cuts to funding for Tier 2, the Championship in England. Can you speak a bit about that?
Yes, the RFU are virtually halving the funding for the Championship. I mean, they sort of flagged it at the beginning of the week, confirmed it yesterday. What they're effectively saying, if you read the statement, is that they don't believe the Championship is an effective player pathway into the Premiership and therefore into international rugby, and they don't see the value in investing in it. To me, looking at that, they're almost saying the Premiership is going to be ring fenced, and therefore there is no point in spending millions on clubs who are never going to get beyond the semi-professional stage. If so, why not just come out and say it? I mean, it's, you know, when you think of the extra money that the Premiership clubs have had from CVC, when you think, you know, the RFU, despite their problems, is still the it's still the union with by far the biggest turnover in international rugby. If those two between them can't properly fund a second tier to the Premiership, then what are they doing? What are they doing in England? You look at France, you've got the top 14 and you've got the second division, which is properly funded, and when two teams each year are promoted, they get the same money as the teams in the top 14. When London Welsh came up a few years ago, they were on, 25-30% of what the others were on, and not surprisingly went back down after a number of serious hidings. It's an indictment, I think, of the game in England, but a prelude to ring fencing.
So, at a practical level, Saracens will be in the Championship next season.
I don't. Despite the wishes of some clubs, I would imagine they would ring fence it after Saracens.
So Saracens get back up, and it either becomes a 13-team top tier.
Yes, I suspect it'll have to become a 13-team. Well, there are 13 members of the Premiership rugby. So you would imagine they would have 13. Now, that, of course, that has implications on Europe because it means there's an extra English club in there, and you've got to somehow, you know, make that work. But there has been talk about expanding Europe by four teams anyway, hasn't there?
To go back to what it was before, 24.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, well, Paul, thanks very much for your insights into all of that, and we'll no doubt be following your stories in The Guardian over the coming weeks and indeed months.
Yes.
Interesting there with the Championship, the cuts that, you know, if the game is generating so much money across the water, and it's 50% is just massive. That's cutting off the lifeblood to some of those clubs, you'd imagine. As competitive forces anyway.
I mean, the reaction from some of them has been very striking indeed. They're talking about forming possibly a breakaway league. They're going to get together and have discussions. The Nottingham chairman, Alistair Bow, said in a statement the RFU had offered no guarantee of any funding beyond next season. Jersey Reds chairman Mark Morgan said announcing the cost of funding when clubs are already signing players for next season was immoral and irresponsible. London Scottish chairman Malcolm Offord said the RFU's decision would lead to fundamental changes to the league. And players, Coventry centre Heath Stevens said it was a kick in the teeth. It showed a lack of respect to players and coaches. It's a bit of a shambles in terms of how it's all been handled. And, you know, player contracts, and they don't earn a pile, you know, some of these earn 20 or 30 grand for the season. It's a massive chasm between the top tier and the second tier. Contracts are up in May and they've got their livelihoods to think about and whether they're going to stick at playing rugby. I mean, a lot of them are going to become unemployed anyway if 50% of the funding, which is roughly 50%, is going from about, say, 550 to 280,000 pounds for the season. It's hard to run a decent sized squad in that.
Yeah, and it's probably just exacerbated by the whole fiasco surrounding Saracens, and, you know, people deem that it's been far too lenient for them, and kind of how they seem to, for want of a better phrase, have been looked after considering what they've done. And then you see these clubs here now who have just been toiling, and now they're getting such drastic cuts that some of those quotes you read out there, obviously they're irate, but I think that's probably, it's in the light of the current rugby environment over there at the moment.
Yeah, and yeah, you can imagine from the player's point of view, of course, as well, where, as you said, you know, that's your lifeblood and it's getting cut off, and where do you go next? And it almost ties in, I guess, to that talk of the way the Six Nations is going to be ring-fenced just on a more local scale. How do you grow the game when you're cutting off quite a large batch of clubs? I don't really understand it.
Yes, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, as in quite a lot of things. But just moving on to the Women's Six Nations, of course, Ireland with two wins out of two, narrow win over Scotland first up, and then a more impressive performance in fairly brutal conditions at Donnybrook to beat Wales. And Raf has been talking to Judy Bobbitt, firstly about how it's going to be obviously tougher against England, but building on the momentum of those back-to-back wins in the opening two rounds.
My aim going in was to get our first two out of the way and definitely pull off a win for both of them. So going forward for the rest of the tournament, we definitely want to push for the win as well. We're kind of fortunate this year that we have the three home games. Just building into the year with the World Cup qualifiers, obviously the Six Nations is our aim, but I think we're looking long term as well for development into the World Cup qualifiers for the summer and just getting game time together. And yeah, like, it's building nicely. Obviously the two away games, we're just looking to put out a good performance and just show what we can do. What happens, happens.
Yeah, and obviously the win over Wales came on a weekend when the weather wasn't at its best, to say the least. How did you approach that challenge? Because it's a bit of an outlier and it's not necessarily something you can... Well, it, I suppose it affects both sides as well, but it's a hard thing to kind of deal with. So how did you prepare for it, and what was the situation then when you got onto the pitch, and whether, I suppose, the preparations were kind of ideal for it?
Yeah, so we'd be keeping an eye on the weather throughout the week, and we go into camp on Thursday. So, like, it was always kind of in the back of my mind that the storm was there. Like, you couldn't really miss it. It was all over the papers and stuff like that. But we did our captain's one on Saturday, and it was actually sunny. It was perfect weather. So we didn't get too much of a taste of what the weather was going to be like. It was sunny. Like, even if you look back at the game in the first half, you couldn't tell that there was a storm coming. But we've been training throughout the winter, and we've been doing camps out in Abbottstown where the weather's literally just been like that. So we've kind of approached the game where if the weather did turn, you know, a lot of forward dominant plays would happen. Just securing the ball and not pushing wide plays. Just keep the ball in hand and kind of reloading quickly.
Yeah, and I suppose it was a bit of a coincidence you were involved against Wales, because that's who you made your test debut against in November. And obviously when you were coming in, you're coming in as a wave of new young players, but the Ireland team that had been there already, you know, they were at a relatively low ebb when we take last season's Six Nations into account. I suppose for you coming in, what kind of mood did you find in the camp, and how positive was it? And I guess what was your role in terms of bringing back a level of positivity as kind of new faces?
Yeah, I think, you know, the girls have been doing great over the last two seasons, just kind of not getting the results and not playing the rugby that they wanted. But it's the same management and the same kind of style that we want to play, and maybe just a few fresh places kind of help that push along. But the senior players definitely, you know, welcome us in as one of their own. And, you know, me, Darrow, and a few of the young ones, Vic and stuff like that, we kind of came in over the summer just after the interviews. Yeah, you're kind of just thrown straight into it, and it's kind of sink or swim. So you're taken as any other player. Like, if you perform, you get rewarded with game time. And, you know, if you're kind of not pushing for place, you might be in the extended panel or whatnot. But it's an environment where you can definitely grow, and it's tough competition in people in your position. But we're kind of at the stage where you're at international level. You want the best players play, and if that means you're not involved, you just have to keep pushing yourself.
Yeah, and your head coach, Adam Griggs, was very pleased with you with your debut all the way back in November. And just, I'm going to bring up a quote from him at the time. So he says, "She's one of those ones now that you see coming through from the underage system. I know there was a photo of her running out for the Six Nations as a mascot. Her family will be proud of her. She's grown up with rugby, and you can see that in her rugby IQ." Maybe the photo first, because I've actually seen it now as well. So you're running out with Fiona Coughlan. Can you remember that? It's obviously a few years ago.
The Six Nations 2009, pretty sure it's against Italy. Kind of, I grew up in Ashburn. Ashburn's my rugby, it's my home club, that's where I would have started. So at that stage, I was the only female member in the rugby club, so I would have kind of gone to all the women's Six Nations anyway. I would have kind of hung around for the autographs after. So I don't know, the opportunity came up to me being a mascot, so I kind of obviously took it. I remember the night being extremely cold anyway. I remember being brought in just outside the change rooms. And I remember the door just being a little bit open, and I could hear the team talk, and I could hear the girls getting ready.
Obviously, Griggs went on to mention as well your rugby IQ, but you've also got the IQ from Gaelic football. So you were a goalkeeper for Meath, right? And back in the day, you won minor medals. In terms of how that affects your game when you're playing rugby, I mean, how much crossover is there? I mean, there are a few skills, I'm sure, that are transferable, but are there moments when, say, you're playing against Wales that a little bit of that football mentality kind of comes back?
Yeah, like, in terms of skill, you're kind of looking at probably the high ball would be the main one. Reactions. I remember when I was a goalie, like, our training would be separate from, you know, the outfield players, and we'd be doing maybe an hour and a half of just reactions there. Quick hands and stuff like that, skill-wise, definitely helps my rugby game. And if you like that, you know, if you ask Emma Considine and Lindsay Pete, they'd say the same. And then kind of mentally, it does, kind of from the Gaelic. You get that team kind of morale that you build around the girls, and like any team sport, it's kind of you work together, and I kind of learned a few skills from the Gaelic that kind of came through to the rugby.
Yeah, and in terms of making the step up from Interpro, so obviously you play for Leinster, and there is a step up when it comes to international rugby, but what's the most, like the first thing you kind of notice when you're making that step up in terms of what is most challenging?
I think probably the most challenging would be the standards. You know, Interpro this year was kind of like a whirlwind. When I got called in the squad in June, I didn't really expect to be that much involved, and I remember getting the email. I was away with friends, and I thought this is the best thing ever to be in the extended panel. So even going from, you know, the Interpros, detail is important during that, but you can kind of get away with nearly the club ethos of, you know, if you can make a few carries yourself. But international rugby, it's kind of very, it is free flowing, but there is a play that you stick to. There is a team plan, and you know, if you kind of veer away from the team plan in any way, you can be punished by other teams.
I know from the Wales game, of course, the pack performed particularly well. Scrummaging was something you focused on, particularly against Wales. And I guess in terms of what you're talking about there, making that step up in terms of detail, there probably is that huge difference in terms of the way you'd focus on scrummaging at Interpro level and then when you're taking on a Six Nations challenge.
I suppose when you're with Ireland, you get a lot more time together to focus on these little things, and there's obviously the whole side of you're looking at video analysis nearly day in, day out during the Six Nations. So you get to know your competitors quite quickly. You get to know your opposite number. We kind of look out for what they're doing, and I'm sure they're the exact same for us. So definitely, yeah, the last week or two, scrummaging was a big part, because for us, we want to make sure we have a good platform. And if we kind of don't have good lineouts or don't have good scrums, we can't play the plays that we want to, and we can't get it out to our backs. So this week in camp, we really just wanted to show that our scrummaging is, you know, up with international standard, which it is. We obviously, if I wasn't in the second row, we probably would have a lot of the smaller pack in comparison to most countries. So we kind of just focus on technique then if we're lacking kind of the weight kind of side of it.
You've got England up next, which is obviously a tough challenge given their standing in the game. Are there specific areas you've looked at? Obviously, from the first two games, you know, it's been positive. There have been two wins. But are there little things you're looking at just to try and, I suppose, make that step up now for, especially it's an away trip as well, to face, as I said, a very tough side in England?
At the moment, like, we've kind of just felt, we're just, for the next game, we're just focusing on us, really, and getting our detail right. You know, we kind of did a review on our attack there last week, and we spotted a few stuff that, if we don't improve, you know, England will capitalise. So we're kind of looking at our end of things and just seeing what we can control. Obviously, you know, in defence, we will be looking at what England brings to the table, and how we can just relieve pressure and, you know, try push them back. We just have a few things that we want to tighten up. And, you know, if that's done, we can execute. And I think it'll pull off.
OK, that was Judy Bobbitt talking to Raf. We're about to wrap up now. Just to remind you that on Sunday week, the women's match, which is in Doncaster against England, both teams with two wins out of two. Well, that is on Sunday on RTE Television, RTE 2 Television. And the men's match will be on RTE 2 FM. So two radio programmes going ahead on Sunday week. The focus on Gaelic games on Sunday Sport on Radio 1, and a special programme from 2:30 on 2 FM to bring you coverage of England against Ireland at Twickenham in the men's Six Nations. That's all we've got time for on this podcast. Thanks indeed to Paul Rees, to Judy Bobbitt for taking the call from Raf, and to Raf and to Declan for joining us here in studio. We'll be back with another edition next week.